Welcome to the Student of the Game podcast with Tim Stone, where I sit down with successful entrepreneurs to extract the knowledge you need to increase your income and avoid simple mistakes. You learn from their failures so you don't have to go through the same thing. I hope that you find one lesson you can apply to your life from this episode. Thank you for listening.
Here we are in person.
There we go. Good to see you again.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to do this event later tonight where you're going to be speaking, and we're hoping to have 100 people. It's weird when you're hosting an event because people RSVP and don't show up, and then people don't RSVP and they do show up. But we've had like 150 or 200 people say that they want to come.
Okay, let's get all 200.
So, should be good. But I don't even think there's room for 50 people at this place. So everyone's going to be standing, and it's going to be awesome.
Well, that's good. I mean, piggybacks the whole nine yards.
So yeah. Well, let's
stack them.
Yeah, let's dive into, I don't know. We've done a podcast before, so I don't have a ton of questions for you, but.
Okay, well, this is a short episode. Good to see you, man.
Yeah, all right. All right, thanks for tuning in.
See you all next time.
What do you have going on? Like, what's new real estate wise, business wise? Like,
I think the biggest project that we've been taking on recently is hotel conversions. So I'm in my second one right now, taking hotels, converting them to multifamily. We've done some other things in the past where we tried to go on different adventures. Like, for those who haven't seen us yet, We're value add multifamily guys. Like, I'm really good. And by I mean my team, my wife, me, my business partner, Cody. We're good at entry-level housing, studios, one beds, up to two beds, and absolutely decking them out. So they're beautiful, but they're all similar, like replaceable parts. So you're talking like same floors, same paint, same countertops, everything kind of looks the same. We can buy in bulk. It's affordable. So that means we can keep our rent down, but we can profitably run those. We can do that all day long. We branched into hospitality around last time we spoke. I bought this beautiful resort on the water, like Hood Canal, Washington. So you have like orcas you can see from some of the cabins going through the canal. Yeah. Like, it's gorgeous. And we're not hospitality people. It made absolutely no business sense.
Yeah. Who runs it? Like, all the short term, in and out, cleaning, all that stuff?
My entire team, who specialized at long term value add rentals.
I bet they love that.
No. And everything else falls on my wife and I. So, like, my wife took a few phone calls for it while we're on. Like, we're out here in Atlanta. The staff's off today. It's like, no one's watching the phone. I guess that's our job. That was a mistake. This one I don't think is a mistake, though. I think this is the type of adventure that makes sense. There's large hotels. A lot of these are studios and one beds, and we're converting them into multifamily. It's a perfect bridge into what we do. In our market, we found a huge opportunity where there's a bunch of mismanaged motels that aren't doing well. They're building a bunch of new hotels that people are using, but the old ones are just dying. So we come in and we do what we do, and new roof, new electric.
Yeah. Affordable housing.
Affordable housing.
So how did you finance it? Did you buy them with creative financing? Or?
Yeah, I bought almost all my portfolio with creative financing, especially the last year. I think a lot of people still really wanted the price they could get the prior year, but interest rates had doubled or tripled. So it's like, we won on terms a ton. Last two transactions I did were both done with hard money.
Hard money.
Because we went on price by a ton on these. And with the hotels, that's been really consistent for me. We also bought an RV park, also on the water. Same water that our resort's on. So this one makes a little bit more sense for us. This project, we bought it for $375, 25 units on the water. It's valued at around $1 million when it's stabilized. It just has a shot septic drain field and needs to work on its collections, which is like super in our wheelhouse. So we've just been winning on price by a ton. So both of my last deals were 120 to 125% financed hard money loans with an exit in 6 months once we stabilize them.
Okay. So what are the terms or like interest rate on the hard money loan? Cause I know you guys did a lot of just seller finance, direct with them, working out the terms, some 0% interest deals. So with that being, you know, obviously a higher interest rate and some sort of balloon period, I'm curious on that. And while you're doing the heavy lifting and the value add, but then what is, you know, putting long-term debt on a motel conversion look like?
So those ones we're doing, so we did hard money at a expensive hard money, 13.5 and 3. And that was the friends and family rate.
Yeah.
He's like, we do 14 and 4, but for you, Christian, we'll do 13 and three. I'm like, that is super expensive.
It used to be 12 and two for everything back in the day.
The nice thing with this though, is that it was the half of the reno budget and 100% of the purchase price up front, which is better than most hard money people will do. So literally no money out of pocket. We got a sizable check for both deals at close. It's a 6 month window to get collections up on these. The motel was ready to lease.
Okay.
So we still.
So someone already did the conversion, or
someone did the conversion. It's still legally a hotel, but the city's like, you can. We don't care. You can do year long leases, and then there's a bunch of banks that are like, we have mezzanine products while you do the conversion, where it's going to bring the rate down to about 9%. So it's still expensive, but they'll go ahead and put it in much less expensive debt on a 2-year IO product with a 5-year balloon.
Yeah, so that's good for the value add process. So were they completely vacant, like zero income, or what was going on with them?
Both were occupied. The hotel that we just bought was 32 units, 16 units occupied. So half full building.
Was it someone that bought it, converted it, and just decided they needed to sell it? Or it was the previous owner that ran it as a hotel and started the conversion?
Yeah, so this one was crazy. The owner lived in this completely dilapidated unit behind the office, and it was like, it was really gross. There's active leaks like coming in through the ceiling. It was super nasty, and it was all painted lime green. Mm. We went in there. He's just been living in there, and he's like, huh, running this as a hotel was kind of hard. So we put everyone in like month by month leases, and we've just kind of been, as units fall apart, we just kind of lease less units. Wow. And that's what was their situation. This thing stabilized because I own a lot on that street, not just in that city, but I mean, we have like 150, 200 units in that town. Mm. On that area, like we're leasing units across the street for $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
32 units. I'm like, okay, conservatively in that area of Washington State, building's worth $2.9 to $3.3 million when it's stabilized, somewhere in that window. Mm. We bought it for $1.6. There's a lot of room to go ahead and do improvements. Mm-hmm. We should spend probably about $400,000 on it. So I think we'll be $2 million all in on a $3 million building. $1 million from upside.
Yeah.
I can borrow a 13.5 for that.
Yeah.
That's okay.
$1 million. Because it's the right debt for what you're doing, what the cycle is going to be like.
Exactly.
I haven't learned it fully yet, but I was reading a book just about like what debt and what exit strategies to have in different cycles of the market. Like we definitely went into a little bit of a recession, rates went up, prices came down. And at some point, historically, we would expect that they're going to come up a little bit. So your game plan is different depending on where you're at when you're buying it.
Exactly.
So this one, you know, you're going to do heavy value add. You expect the market to come up. Maybe rates will be better. If not, the property is going to be worth more.
Mm-hmm.
So the hard money is not a long-term product because you don't need it right now.
No. And our entire brand is long-term cash flowing fixed rate debt. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of comments like, that's not long-term. I'm like, well, it's an 18-month product and I have an exit for 6 months. I have a path to get there. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do this as someone's first deal though.
Right.
Like a heavy lift on a 32-unit hotel. It's like, you're going to lose way too much money on what I call the stupid tax, which is you do anything new, you just pay a premium to learn all the things you didn't know when you got started.
Mm-hmm.
We've done this type of project a bunch of times. This isn't even the first hotel that I've converted. So I'm like, I understand the game here.
Mm-hmm.
We pay a little bit less stupid tax. You have $1 million buffer in what you can make, but it's really easy at borrowing 13.5. The danger there is if you take way too long on something, 13.5% eats you a lot faster than the mistakes you make at seller financed 4% debt.
Yeah. And it could cause you to sell quicker than you wanted to. And if you're half wrong, you make $500,000. So I think there is a lot of room on it.
I do like that. Yeah. And there is a possibility someone is entertained, like, I might just buy it for 2.6. I'm like, oh, if I don't do the project and I have $1 million of upside still, it's like, yes, you may pay me to leave. I borrowed $1.8 million on $1.6 million purchase. I'm like, after fees, get paid $750,000 to not do the project. While I don't like walking away, I think I can do that.
See, I personally now would take that deal. If you asked me a year ago, anything we could possibly get our hands on, I want to try to keep it as long as possible. But now I'd be like, yeah, take that money. Take your profit and go put it into another one.
Why did that change for you?
A lot of it really just talking with Shane just on how he structures his exit strategies is like he's got a property that, you know, he'd consider something like that. Like it could be something he could keep forever or he could get $1 million now and then use it to, you know, make whatever the difference was. You know, maybe he could sell in a few years and make $3 million. But if he can get $1 million now, what can he buy that's going to be worth more than $3 million? In 5 years.
Exactly.
So it's just the, I guess, the time value of money. Or you could, you know, if you're using other people's money and getting creative, you can just do it all.
Mm-hmm.
But previously I was like, yep, figure out how to get the long-term fixed rate debt, like you're talking about, keep it forever. But I don't know. My opinion's kind of just been changing a little bit. Like,
I think it depends on what phase you're in. Like mm-hmm. if you're someone who's starting in multifamily or you have a small portfolio and you're trying to scale up, it's like if your goal is to grow the portfolio, then grow the portfolio. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, even last year, it's like just hold everything and build the portfolio. Now we're a little north of 200 units. Cody and I have majority of those, either just us own it or we have like one partner on them. I don't really need more real estate to do anything. Like I have mm-hmm. enough equity. You have three resource pools. You have cash flow, you have liquidity, you have equity. You're rich when you have all of those in the levels you want and they're in balance. Right now I have very little liquidity, a ton of equity, and actually very decent cash flow right now, minus the hotels that are mid-project. Everything's performing really well.
Mm-hmm. Liquidity would be awesome
there. Liquidity would be great. Yeah. I'm out of balance there. So I'm like, okay, I would trade some equity for liquidity because that's the fun thing with your resource pools. For a cost, you can trade any resource for another one. It's a lot like Settlers of Catan or any other resource management game, except you only have three pools. And you're like, well, you can trade this at a fee to turn your equity into liquidity. You can turn your equity into more cash flow. Like one of the things that we did early in our career is we had equity partners on a deal. We needed to get them off the deal to go through a bank refinance. And so they seller financed their equity back to us. Mm-hmm. So we turned equity, we spent cash flow to gain equity, but you can swap any resource for any resource with a tiny bit of liquidity. Yeah,
you just put the equity into debt basically in that situation. Like were they a second lien on the property or how did that work? We may be getting a little too nerdish.
They were a general partner in the LLC. And so we came in as partners and we bought out a partner by them financing their ownership to us.
That's smart.
But all of this is to illustrate, you just try to keep your pieces in balance. When you're starting, all the money is in the deal. And if you have a lack of deals, then it's like you don't have a whole lot of pieces. So I would front load, buy the real estate that you can hold and own. And later on, different plays become available. And maybe you do take the liquidity play. I was talking with my buddy Caleb about this, actually. Mm-hmm. You've met Caleb.
Yeah.
Caleb Hommel, one of our first mentees, he's 21 now. He bought 56 units, I believe. 56 multifamily units. He's under contract for a 26 unit. So he's doing really well. Mm. Someone offered like, would you wholesale this to me? And if this was last year, I would have been like, don't you dare. You are trying to build a portfolio. If you become a wholesaler, you're going to get addicted to cash and you're never going to own anything. Mm-hmm. With 50 something units, 21 years old, you get a 6-figure wholesale assignment for someone who really wants the fantastic deal you just negotiated. I might actually say you should take it.
Yeah. It was different, I feel like, a couple of years ago when you could just do a cash out refinance, get that couple $1 million and still keep the property. But now it doesn't really make as much sense anymore. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it's okay for your opinion to change. And especially like we kind of got into it, you know, we're both pretty young, got into it not that long ago. Mm-hmm. So it's like we haven't been through every market cycle and things are just different now.
Yeah.
But so that being said, what's different now when you're acquiring properties and looking at deals? Like last few years, you're like creative finance. How can we just get great debt on this and keep it forever? Mm-hmm. What's different now?
I think the big piece for me is, it's also creative finance. I think what's different now is I'm more interested in larger deals because we're a little bit farther. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, like if someone's like, hey, I have a sixplex and it needs a lot of work, I'm just not as interested in doing that project because it's just not as exciting. If you put a hotel in front of me and you go like, hey, convert this. I'm like, okay, well the ROI on that is going to be $1 million deal. $1 million upside deal is more exciting to me. And if that means I just need to buy bigger real estate, that's really the only thing that's changed because it's still creative, right? Even the hard money thing, it's saying what pieces do we have? This deal is not bankable right now. Like a hotel with a failed roof and bad electric is not going to.
Right. It's not going to pass an inspection.
Yeah. And it's a failed hotel.
Get a good bank loan on it. Yeah.
Exactly. But it's a project that you can turn around. It's like, okay, we have to get creative. If it's hard money into mezzanine debt into perm financing, awesome. There's also a lot of people who buy those once you do the conversion. So it's like, if we didn't get our perm financing, because I don't know what your crystal ball is for 2 years from now, but I'm kind of like, I don't know what the market's going to do. It's like, okay, well, it's going to be easy to sell, stabilized. We know we're good at stabilizing it. So just, I think for me, it's been a dedication to find the thing that you're best in the world at. For me, entry level, value add, multifamily, and then just like double, triple, quadruple down on that in your market. Mm-hmm.
And are you guys still doing just looking for the seller finance deals or?
Funny enough, I've never actually looked for them. I just, that's what I found. Because this always goes back to the resources. I didn't have cash. I'm like, I have to play with hard money or creative finance. And in the last, we'll say 18 months, winning on terms, I think, was the number one way to play the game. Mm-hmm. Too many people still wanted the higher price or just had shock over like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I've been, my balance sheet said I'm worth this and I'm just not.
Because they were getting that price 2 years ago.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think it's set in now and people have been more realistic on price. So it's like, okay, now we're going to start winning the game on price more often, but it's still creative finance. That's the same exact question. How do I buy it? How do I never lose it? I need to be able to answer both sides of that. And so acquisition is just, what are the pieces and how do we move them? This hotel, they wanted to move. They need to be cashed out. Awesome. Okay. Well, we're not seller financing.
Yeah. How can we do it?
Yeah. Well, it's like, okay. Do you take check? Let's get the money in and get it done.
Yeah. Because it's all problem solving, especially now. A lot of people just kind of have one way of buying properties. And right now that it doesn't really make sense to go to the bank and get a 7% interest rate on a commercial deal at the prices people want. A lot of people are just sitting on the sideline. Mm-hmm. So how do you, or what are you doing to figure out what makes sense for the deal and communicate it in a way that you can do it creatively? Because I think that's a hurdle for a lot of people. It's like, you know, look at this deal and I'm kind of running the numbers and I understand it.
Yeah.
But if I went to the bank, my debt service would be more than the property nets every month. Yeah. The bank won't even do that deal. Mm-hmm. But I guess what people need to do is figure out, okay, how can we make this, how can we make sense of it? Like every deal is going to be different.
And I think you narrated that perfectly. They asked the question, well, if I take this to the bank, that it's like, that's already the wrong train of thought for a deal. Mm-hmm. You haven't figured out the debt and equity yet. The order is always deal, then debt, then equity. All the money is in the deal and that will tell you what structure you need. So figure out the deal first. If people go like, oh, well, I'm only looking at these things that the bank will do, or I saw this video on house hacking. And so I'm only looking at deals that I can do a perfect burr on after I house hack it. It's like, well, you're just not going to find a lot of deals. You might buy some real estate and it's a good strategy, but if you just marry one way of doing real estate, you're only going to see things through that lens. So it's look at the opportunities around you and then ask yourself, what do they need to sell this and how would I buy it and then never be in a position where I have to sell it? Like, how do I buy it? How do I never lose it? That's literally the whole thing. You just don't add anything to that. So
how did you learn to come up with that solution or to be sure enough to actually buy something that I can get it and I'm not going to lose it?
Oh, well, I'll tell you how we came up with the motto. Cause essentially what we did is I branded to buy and hold. You need to buy and then hold.
Makes sense to
Ta-da.
Me.
Ta-da. Yeah. Hard to refute. We had a mentor really early on who was amazing at buying anything. Like could buy any property that he wants. The problem was he would just lose them. Like he bought a whole bunch of condos and then 2008 happened and he lost all of them. And the next thing he did, he's like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to overpay for a ton of office buildings and I'm going to, which he had no experience in. He's like, I'm going to do this whole co-working thing and I'm just going to be like a local WeWork. And it's going to make so much money. By the way, I was working at CoStar at this time, largest data company in the world for commercial real estate. The price that he needed per square foot to make that deal work would have been getting a little bit more on a, I think it was a 1910 office, like built 1910, super old, everything. Yeah. Not super updated.
110 years old.
Yeah. The price he would have needed per square foot would have been a little bit more than what Amazon was leasing their new tower for that they just finished building in Bellevue, Washington.
Brand new building
by Amazon. Mm-hmm. I'm like, there's a 0% chance it was ever going to work, but he creatively financed it and he somehow got people to throw money at it and he bought it. And so I remember sitting in the office with my business partner, Cody Davis. And this is back when Cody was 20. And I'm like, dude, if you bought these things, if it's this easy to buy them, but all you did was just figure out how am I not going to lose them? Couldn't you just buy literally anything? And I brought it up to that same guy too. I was like, what would keep you from buying the multifamily that you tell everyone to buy? And his answer was super shocking. He's like, I'm not financeable. I'm like, you've never bought anything with financing. Like you've never used conventional finance. Why would that possibly hold you back? For some reason, he was allergic to deals that actually make money. He's like, I could sell anyone on anything. So I'm only going to do bad deals. I was like, okay. That's how we came up with that. And so then the question became like the first deal, 38 units. We've never raised capital. 15% down is what they needed because that paid off the debt that they owed on this building. $2 million purchase. Heavy value add, which we had no experience in. This was like new roof, fix the chicken infestation, clear the homeless camp.
Chicken infestation?
Dude, they were everywhere. They were everywhere. Two units just had chickens living in their units, and then they release them into the courtyard every day, and then they make more chickens. And it was a legitimate problem.
I've seen that with cats, but not chickens.
And I'll also say there are a significant amount of cats there. I think they enjoyed the chickens. But that's what we had. It was a huge project. But instead of going like, okay, the bank's never going to, their collections on 38 units was $5,000 a month.
Wow. Like, well, what's the occupancy? People just weren't paying?
People just weren't paying. So it was like 66% occupied and like a third of those people were paying. And I was like, okay, well, not bankable at all. It's been on market for 12 years since my business partner was 8 years old. But you stabilized 38 units. And the valuation, we pegged it at about 3.5. Appraisal ended up coming in at 4.1 when we did it 11 months later. Mm-hmm. But like that project came about not because we're like, oh, wow, everyone's scared of this project. They know more than us. It's just like, I see the vision for this property. I believe that we can buy this. And I think we're the only guys who are young and energetic enough to take on this big of a project. Because everyone who has more money is going to buy a more stable asset. And all the smaller investors want to buy a duplex or a fourplex. Your market for a beat up 38 unit building is like only us. Mm-hmm. So let's just be the guys who do it. And then we did it and we made seven figures on our first deal together. I was like, we should do more of this.
Yeah.
This is good.
When you see a deal like that, your first thought is, oh, what's wrong with it? It's been on the market. You said 12 years it was on the market.
Yeah. And that was the great thing. Everything was wrong with it. And you know that up front. It's like, what's wrong with it?
What are people seeing that I'm not seeing? Because obviously people smarter than me have looked at this, but kind of like you said, like the people smarter than you, they kind of just want an easier deal. Mm-hmm. And then the people who are just beginners and, you know, could probably do it are scared, but it doesn't mean there won't be money made. Like every deal that I've passed on, I'm like, someone will probably make money on this, but I don't know if I want to be that guy.
Yeah. And that's the question you have to ask. Like that one, we knew it was going to be a hard project. It's like, do we want to be the guys on this? And I was like, I have four units right now. This would put me in 42 units. That moves me forward. I think I do want to be the guy on this. Let's do it.
Yeah. So that was the first, other than a duplex or quadplex.
Two duplexes. Yeah.
Two duplex. Other than duplex, that was like the first big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how'd you structure that one? You've told me before, but I don't remember.
No, that's fine. By the way, how we got creative finance on it was awesome. I don't think a lot of people do this. We asked. No one asked in 12 years. It wasn't listed with seller finance. You just... like, would you be willing to cut your contract? They're like, oh, that never works. We need to see $10,000 a month payments. I was like, can those payments start 6 months in? And we do astronomically lower payments right after we close it and write you a $300,000 check. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, that'd work. That's all we did. And then we got the collections up. Right now, it brings in $30,000 a month. So it's like we got it from $5,000 to $30,000 in 2.5 years. The $10,000 payments were never the issue.
Yeah, never an issue.
We just needed to buy a little bit of time because we didn't have any reserves at all or any of the things that one would need to do a deal of that size. Yeah.
That's one thing I'll say to people. And if I'm kind of trying to have the more creative finance conversation on a property, is like, you and I both know this is going to be worth more, but it's not worth that yet. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't get paid. Like, exactly. Like, there's a deal I had a call with a seller this morning that we could pay you $500 a month now. Once we fix it up, we could very easily pay you $1,500 a month, but this thing doesn't make that much money. You know, we can get it there. This is going to be worth a lot more, but the reason you're having trouble selling it and you've been trying to sell it for 6 months is because right now it's not worth what you want to get out of it. So we can get creative here. And you think that just because of YouTube and podcasts like this and you guys and Pace More being a lot of educators in the creative, you think everybody knows this stuff and everybody's pitching it, but it's really not that many people.
No.
Especially if you live like kind of in your market, like how many people in that market are actually doing that kind of stuff? Some of them.
Yeah. The guys who taught us.
Not everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. It's like we learned from the people who own over 100 units in that market. Like that. If anyone wants to do this, like I'm all for paid mentorships. I'm a huge fan of them. I've taken many, but the best way to play the game is who's done what you want to do in the market you're in, and then go meet them and ask them instead of like, can I buy your stuff? Be like, can you help me on how you got from A to B? Cause here's where I'm stuck. So it's like, I have two duplexes. You have a 38 plex. how would one acquire a 38-plex? Is a great way to start a relationship with the people who know to play the game. They're the ones who taught us how to structure these. To your question, that deal, that was 4% interest, but we had to do a custom amortization to get the payments up to 10. So we're paying down the principal on that thing like crazy, which is excellent.
Okay. The custom amortization is something that you showed me for the first time. And, and I want you to break that down. Just like, I don't even remember what the numbers were on that deal, but it was like, yeah, we'll pay you this much and then it'll go to this interest rate and then this interest rate. Once the property makes more money, we can pay you more money.
Yeah. So a custom amp. So essentially if you're looking to bring this down to a basic, if you're someone who's buying their first house, like we'll keep it that simple. Usually you have a 30-year amortization. That's the most common. There's 20, there's 15, but essentially says throughout this period of time, you're going to pay off your loan. So you pay your interest. And on top of that, you pay principal until your loan is paid off in 30 years. That's the math. Instead of doing a 30-year AM, you can just set the AM to like it's amortized in a way where the principal payment is X amount per month. It's just a custom AM. We negotiated. It's 4% interest, which someone smarter at math can do that in their head again. It's been a second since we had that.
I have a rule. I don't do math on camera.
That's really smart. Yeah. So for you watching at home, 4% interest on a $1.7 million loan. And the additional is how much principal we pay down to get to 10,000. We started without the additional principal, and then that kicks in at month six.
So it kind of adds to the back end of the loan, or?
Essentially. So what it does is it just says, hey, we're going to start paying this down, but those payments aren't going to kick in until month six. So it's basically structured like an interest-only loan up until that point, and then you start paying principal. There's not a custom timeline on like, oh, it's going to be paid off in X time. The amortization is just we're paying X amount of principal. I did that on my second deal too. Mm-hmm. They wanted to see a little higher payments. We just negotiated a flat $1,000 of principal that's added to the interest. Mm. And it just chunks it down, $1,000 a month, every month, like clockwork. Custom AM. It's a good way. So here's how we got it. We learned where the goalposts were. What do they need? They've been trying to sell this forever. They would like to be cashed out. That's never going to happen. No one's buying this in cash. Can't get a bank loan. They wouldn't mind $10,000 a month. That's the next best thing. It can't support $10,000 a month. That's where most people get stuck. How could we do that? Just say yes to everything they want. Yes, we will give you the $10,000 a month. Here's what it will look like. It starts in 6 months. Creative finance needs to be simple because if it's simple, it's repeatable. If it's repeatable, it's scalable. And that's when you know you have a viable business, if it's infinitely scalable. I don't think we can buy all the real estate in the world. So by definition, if we can buy this to do this simply and we can do it again and again and again, I'm going to say we can do this till we die and just continue to expand. So if you keep it that simple, you can do it. Where you get messed up on these is where you get too creative and you all of a sudden have like, oh, we're doing some crazy tax stuff and some special allocations. And then you're going to get an extra piece of the cost seg. We've done this before. And I'm like, I hated every second of it. And like 80% of it worked the way I thought it would. And then when it got to tax time, 20% of it didn't. And I was like, well, this is awkward.
It is.
Super simple things. I can't afford $10,000 a month right now. I'm just going to say yes to $10,000 a month. And I'm going to present them a path, which gets them right there. That's how we got done.
Yeah. It's super
doing cool. The deal.
I think a lot of people, just because it's how most people do it. A lot of people think like the bank, like we're going to do it this way. We're going to have this amortization. It's set. Like the loan is the loan. That's how we're going to do it. But when you're creative, there's no bank. It's me and you. What do you need? Can I do that? I think I could do that. Like I want to be sure I can fulfill the promise I'm giving you. So we're going to have to do it this way. But yeah, like there's no one else involved. Obviously you got to make sure it's legal and the tax implications and talk to a CPA and attorney and all that stuff. But
that's their job.
Yeah, it is.
Just come with something like, simple and be like, how do we do this? And then they agree. And then you send it to the other person's attorney. And if they say yes, it's like, okay, cool. Well, then sign here and here.
Yeah. And that's a good question. Just like if you can have a realistic conversation with the seller, how can we do this? You want $10 million right now. I mean, you know, I could see it being worth that or more, but the bank is going to look at this deal and say it's worth six. How can we do this? You know, how can we get you that? I can lowball you, take $4 million out of your pocket, or we can figure out how to make it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. You put together the goals and you're like, what would you like? And then if you have a path to say yes to all of them, you're going to get the deal done. Sometimes They want something that just is not feasible. And I think I've done so much talking online on like, just figure out what they want and then do it. There are people like, I've run into a deal and I'm stuck here. How would you do this? I'm like, you can't. sometimes you can't sometimes say yes.
Yeah.
But you need to figure out, okay, what is it that they're trying to accomplish and can it be done? Sometimes it is unreasonable and sometimes you don't do every deal and that's okay. But there are enough deals out there where if you're just looking at, even if it's just a few deals a week, you're just consistently looking at a few deals. How would this work? How would this work? Bounce some ideas off people. It's amazing how often you buy real estate. I probably look at 2 or 3 deals a week, maybe. And we buy on average a deal every 60 days. Mm. I make one phone call a day on average to book one coffee meeting every weekend, which means I meet 50 owners a year who I hadn't previously met. Like that's not hard prospecting or hard work.
No.
It's just.
Do you have to be a tough and brutal negotiator to get the deals?
I don't. Because I'm just saying yes to whatever they want in a way that cash flows on long-term fixed rate debt. Like the rules aren't hard. Own it, don't lose it. Long-term cash flowing fixed rate debt. Every time I close a deal, my income goes up. And then when I get enough income, I can do one of those really crazy value add projects like a hotel where it's like, yeah, that doesn't cash flow day one because it's an empty hotel or it's a half full hotel. Mm-hmm. But you take the cash flow from everything. You do one big project. That's the other thing that kills people is they do 10 great deals at the same time, that negative cash flow. And then the markets crash and they're like, oh, what do I do?
Yeah. You have to get to a certain point.
Exactly.
But that is like you said, for the first deal, you shouldn't do that motel conversion.
No.
But at some point, someone should do that deal because you're going to make $1 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you're 5 deals in, you have some idea what you're doing and you have some cash flow to lay back on, you do that deal. And then you stabilize that one and you have more cash flow and then you're able to do bigger deals. It's a big problem I think I saw, I think we all saw in the last market cycle, syndicators. They did these skinny deals on short-term debt products, a lot of them variable rate interest, because the market's gone up and up and up and up. And they got stuck on their deal and they have to sell it and they can't get their price. And that's where we're seeing a ton of the problems with banks. All you need to do is just figure out, do I have enough cash flow and liquidity to do this project? And if it's no, it's like, okay, let's do some more smaller deals, build up the portfolio. This is one of the first things that we learned getting into real estate. This guy's a developer, a really successful developer. Probably, I'm going to ballpark, he's probably worth like $50 million. He started from literally nothing, moved to America, no money, traded his first Honda for his first property. He just bought the car, needed it for a down payment, negotiated, hey, what if I trade you the car? So he built this whole, you know, $50 million net worth by developing. I'm like, well, how do you develop and make money consistently? Because developers are the richest people on earth until they're not. Like you get stuck on a project there, a half-built building brings in exactly no money. So how do you survive that? He's like, well, I bought 40 dumpy rentals and then I fixed them up and then I paid them off. And he's like, and out of the cash flow of 40 rentals, when something gets stuck on a development project, or he was building during COVID and material cost 3X, he's like, people got wiped out, but I didn't because I already built my stable business and I took the higher risk projects after I locked in my wins. And so we just took that to our entire model and said, like, okay, well, if you can't afford the hotel conversion yet, but it's the deal you want to do, do more little deals and stabilize them. And when you have enough cash flow to survive the project, do that project then. Just don't go negative in cash flow. Just don't do it. Mm. And then you don't lose.
Yeah. So are you going to start developing next?
No, I will not. Cody wants to. Cody's going to do a lot of development. I love redeveloping projects. Like I love doing heavy value add. If it's a beat up building, it's just fun for me to get in there and be like, I can see what this thing could be. Looking at a raw piece of land and being like, I want to go through the permitting and the build and the, zero interest. I do not want to do that. I like having old stuff made new is exciting to me.
I'm with you on that. I do think the people that can look at a raw piece of land and see what it's going to be, they make a lot of money and they're good at it, but it is kind of terrifying. Like, oh, the zoning, what if we buy the land and the city doesn't let us do what we wanted to do or blah, 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 or material cost goes up, we can't make the debt payments, all that kind of stuff. But the people that pull it off, like you said, they probably have some other stable business, something bringing in income that can support it.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen cities change their mind too on these.
Yeah.
Where they're like, oh yeah, no, you're totally gonna be able to do this. Then people buy it and they're like, ah, you know, I actually changed my mind. The nice thing with buying an apartment building is like you have a dumpy apartment building.
You go want it to be better.
They want it to be better. There is the first hotel conversion we bought. It's a 22 unit hotel right next to the city council, like their main building.
Yeah, they probably pay you to do something to it.
Their original take when we said what we wanted to do was this building is not zoned for that. We need it to be hospitality. I'm like, but you hate this being hospitality. They're like, yeah, but it's just it just is. It's, we're not going to approve multifamily here. I'm like, okay, what can we do? They're like, well, I mean, you can lease it like multifamily and just. It's going to be legally a hotel, but you can run it as multifamily. But I mean, that's the best you can do. We're kind of resistant to that idea. I'm like, okay, look, you have two options. I'm going to buy this and I'm going to run it as a multifamily building. Or this other guy who you really don't like is going to buy it and he's going to run it into the ground and you're going to have to look at it every day and there's going to be homeless everywhere. And they're like, oh, you know what? That's a good point. We want you to buy it. I'm like, okay, cool. Hmm.
And then you have that in writing that you're allowed to lease as multifamily?
Yes. And you need to do that prior to close. That's part of your due diligence. You don't have to lock these up. Like, sure, you can put them in a contract and put down a little bit of money to like, hey, I'm going to take a bet that this is going to work. But don't close these without getting it in writing from the city because the city will say yes on a lot of stuff. And then when you close, they go, oh, you know, we took a closer look at this. We decided that it is in everyone's best interest for you to do this project, but we still don't care. I have a parking lot that we own next. It's attached to multifamily that cash flows. So it's a 6-unit building with an acre of land. The parking lot used to be an impound lot. Our proposal to the city was, can we make this paid parking that is needed here? They're like, no, we don't want the use to be parking. I'm like, it's an impound lot. I'm proposing that you take this parking lot and use it for parking. They're like, I don't think that's the right use. I'm like, can I build multifamily on it? No. Can I build self-storage on it? Yes, but we want you to pave the whole thing and then pay us a ridiculous fee for water runoff. I'm like, well, no one's going to do that. They're like, okay, well, land's good too. We'd love downtown land. No sense.
Mm.
That deal made sense without buying that, which is why we bought it. But it was a stellar deal if you could build literally anything on it. And the city blocked everything that they were like, oh yeah, we'll be fine with this. And we got in and they're like, no. So... if you're going to play the development game or the city permitting game, all done in writing prior to close.
Yeah. So where do you recommend someone starts? Because that stuff can sound kind of scary. Like, is it stuff that I honestly don't even want to deal with? Like, where should someone start to start building a real estate portfolio?
Okay, number one, define what your actual goal is. Pretty basic, right? But I think a lot of people are like, my goal is to own real estate. I'm like, okay, good. Yeah, that's whatever you build is not going to look like what you think. So... what do you actually want to do? For me, it was build a $20,000 a month passive income. That was my first thing. And that was to be able to retire my wife from teaching in a crazy school district in Seattle. And that was to move me to, and her to Texas in the house that we want to live in, which is being built right now, which is awesome. But that's what we wanted to put together. So I'm like, how do we build to that? With that in mind, it's like, okay, choose the deals that you're comfortable with and then go a little bit bigger. I'm not saying like, if you want to buy a duplex, start with a 38-plex. That's a lot. But if you wanted to buy a duplex and you find a 10 or 12-plex in your market, you can take on that project. That is doable for literally anyone. Buy that slightly bigger deal. Learn to manage it and scale a portfolio that makes the amount that you need to make. Stabilized. Now you have your cash flow. What I recommend people do from there is you optimize it. So that's if it needs, you know, stabilized means maintenance is in good order and it's at least 95% leased.
Mm-hmm.
Optimize is like, we have a new roof on this, brand new water heaters, high efficiency windows. And if we had to build, like if we converted a basement into another unit, like it's now optimal. This is the best this building can be. And then I would pay off the debt because that's what our first mentors did. So they like the good ones is they paid off the debt. So if you're getting started, how big do we need to build? And once stabilized, is it cash flow the amount that I want? Then let's go buy to that as efficiently as you can. If that costs you 100 rentals, the fast way to get there is buy 100 unit. You're probably not going to start there. But if you do, you know, 425 unit projects, that's not that hard to do. And then you're there. And I think a lot of people think way too small in real estate. They end up with a whole bunch of problems because they have a ton of roofs, a bunch of single family, a bunch of duplexes. And it's hard to manage and it takes forever. So if you're starting, choose your comfort level, choose your goal, buy a little bit bigger than that. Good to go.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'm curious to know your opinion on is, say you buy a, you wind up buying 200 units with creative financing, all this stuff, and you're going to have some balloon. A lot of people don't talk about it, or maybe don't know that there is a net worth requirement with the bank when you're going to go refinance that property. Like, what does someone need to know when they start getting into the bigger stuff? And maybe they're just pretty early on, but they got a good opportunity at, you know, a big portfolio. You know, how would someone set themselves up to actually keep the property? Because that could happen. Like, you know, I could go find a 250 unit for $30 million and buy it creatively, all this stuff. I don't have a $30 million net worth. The bank's going to decline me on the loan.
Well, not all of my seller finance notes have balloons. So we have 30-year fully amortized debt. So some of them
don't care. Awesome.
Don't care. Like, yeah, doesn't matter. Doesn't go to
doesn't matter. Yeah.
You're not going to get a lot of that. We have a lot of 15-year debt. So a lot of them, it's like, do I believe that I can be worth more in 15 years? Yes. I'm willing to take that bet because I have a long time to figure that out. But if you're getting into a deal, like 38, perfect example. To get a bank loan on that, our first loan, I think, was $2.3 million when we got, we refinanced it twice in 2.5 years because we started broke and had to pull money out.
Yeah.
Could have structured it better. But when we did that deal, Cody and I were each worth, and granted, we didn't have any cash, but we had, both of us had some real estate. Yeah. We were both worth about $400,000. So our combined net worth was $800,000. You need to have a net worth of about the value of your deal is typically what a bank wants to see. There's some flexibility there, but around there, since we're not worth the $2.3 million we need for that loan, we either need to get our net worth up in the time that we refinance, or which you can do just by improving the deal. Like if you own the deal, you can get equity in your actual deal to help you qualify.
Yeah. Or say you have 10, 15 years, you can pay down a lot of that debt and like that goes to your net worth.
Absolutely. The other thing you can do is you can bring on a capital partner who has the net worth and has the experience. And we do that a lot. If you're buying deals without money, you traditionally either do zero down, which is extremely uncommon, or you just bring in one partner who's like, I have money. You guys have time. Let's partner. You guys bring the deal, especially seller financed. You're not just bringing the deal. You're like, I'm bringing the deal. And this is like 90% seller finance. So I'm bringing the deal and 90% of the money and all the work. Just find someone who can write a check. There's a lot of people who can write a check and they ride the deal with you. And it's like, okay, at refi, we'll do this. And if you want to put a clause in there to buy them out at some certain point in time, make sure that you still qualify for that financial liability, whatever that is. It's bank financing. Make sure the bank's aware that you're doing that and get it assigned to you and you have the net worth to do so. But there's a lot of ways to play around that. The easiest two are be worth more. And if you can't do that in the time that you need, find someone who is.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, how do you find those people that you can trust and partner with? But I wanted to tell a story. I was at one of the first real estate conferences I went to is a Grant Cardone event. Mm-hmm. And he asked the question that kind of put things into perspective for me. He's like, raise your hand if you have more money than you have time. Like half the room put their hand up. And he's like, if you have no money, that's who you need to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are people out there that have more money than they have time. And then if a lot of people that listen to this are younger, you know, close to my age, we got more time than a 70-year-old that has, you know, a net worth of $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people out there. But I was going to ask you, like, how do you find that person?
You look at the people who've done what you want to do, and you go take them out to coffee. I mean, it's the same way that guy I told you about who's like, oh, I became a developer by paying off these 40 units. The people who taught us seller financing, a lot of these people are the people who fund our deals because you're going to the people who've already done the thing. Traditionally, the people who've already done the financial goal that you want have more money than you. Otherwise, you're talking to the wrong people. It's like, I lost my business. I'm like, there's probably some takeaways there, but there's probably not going to be like my main, I'm going to go to you for how you built your business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you network with the people who've done exactly what you want to do.
Yeah.
For me,
build relationships.
Yeah. For me, it was, I wanted to get to 100 multifamily units. Now, unit count doesn't actually matter. It's a stupid metric, but it is what I wanted. Like just factually, that's what I used. And so I went, who in my market has 100 units? Take them all to coffee.
How'd you find them?
Google Maps. It's the magical map that has every single property. You just click on the property. If you can't find any, funny enough, you're in Georgia, which is actually a slightly harder place than almost anywhere else to find public record data. I have found it is ludicrously hard. I had a data company that tried to mine some of Georgia and the City Records had me pay $150 for them to burn me a CD and mail it back to Washington. So it works everywhere. It may be different levels of organization depending on where you're at, but you click on a building, you get an address. You usually type in something like whatever county parcel map. Find the parcel. It has ownership data attached to it. You Google whoever owns it. Is it an LLC? Google it. Is it an individual? Google them with the name, phone number, or the word phone number. And then you get a phone number, and then you dial the phone number, and 9 times out of 10, it goes to someone. You pick up the phone. We've done this with so many people. If you guys watched our episode of the Brad Lee podcast, and yes, it's our episode. They had two cameras. They put it on Brad and Cody, and I'm on the couch.
I know.
My voice is there. Listen for me.
Yeah, I listened to it, and I think I watched it on YouTube, and they didn't put you on camera.
I'm very bitter about this. Brad, get me back in there. But like that podcast, I was like, we should be on this podcast. I like this podcast. And so we Googled his name and his company. And we found his company. It typed in the word phone number. And I typed it into my iPhone. And it lit up blue. And then Cody came in and texted him. He's like, hey, I just bought a resort and we use one of your products. Can I be on the podcast? He's like, sure. Come on down. Done. He's done something that I want to do. I want to have this cool, like, I want to have a cool podcast one day. You have a cool podcast. We're on it right
Thank
now.
Thank you. Thank
you. I'm not there yet. I have a YouTube channel though. Multifamily Strategy. Check it out. YouTube. But he has done something that I want to do. He has something that I want. And so we sent him a message and said, hey, I'm going to be in Vegas around this time. Are you open to have two of your clients on the pod? He's like, heck yeah, I am. Let's go. That's how we found his number. It works for literally everyone though. So this is how we find all the owners. Who owns this building? Google them. Google the phone number. Give them a call. Grab coffee and don't ask them to buy their stuff. Just talk to them like a normal person. Most people's kids don't want to inherit the real estate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. Like you would think, oh, they're just going to pass it on to their kids. But if you Rarely. Imagine the scenario, like you're in your 70s or 80s, you're ready to retire. Your kids are probably in their late 40s or 50s.
Mm-hmm.
They moved off to wherever, moved to Chicago, you know, started their family, all this stuff. And then your parents pass away and now you have 40 rental properties halfway across the country and you don't know anything about them. Some people would rather just get a check.
Yeah. Or
a monthly payment for the next 20 years.
Monthly payments. That was one of the first people who we bought from. That was their whole thing. They're like, I have too many rentals. I'm trying to sell or finance a few of these every year so that when I pass, I don't just give my kids a pile of money, but they can't manage the properties because we have way too many of them and they're not in the business. And they'll blow through all the cash. So I just want to give them seller finance notes. That's the estate plan. And mm-hmm. they don't want the tax hit of selling everything all at once. So they're like, I've already made money. I don't need more money. I don't need to be cashed out. That's counterintuitive to what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to buy it. They came down and said, hey, would you like to buy one of our properties? And once they propose a deal, then you can start talking transaction. Let them open transactions. I've still never asked for a deal. I've never asked anyone to sell anything before. They proposed a sixplex and we came into their office and I asked, if your plan is to sell 5 properties every year, what if we were just the buyer for all of them? You want to do this over 5 years? Let's just knock them out one at a time. Every single one that you'll do, I will knock out every single one. And he was quiet for a second. He's like, he's super deep voice too. He's like, that's exactly what I would like to do. I was like, oh, perfect. We're in. And that's someone who has consistently sold us a bunch of deals. And there's been a few people like that. You meet 50 people a year, one or two are open to a proposal of like, wow, you've built an empire. He's like, yes, I would like to sell it to someone else who would also like to build on my empire. It's like, sweet. Can I have all of it? You don't need that many yeses and you're set.
Right.
And you assimilate, especially if you're starting young, like you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you're already, you know, you've amassed quite a portfolio. And as you play the game, it's like you get one or two more people who are like, yes, I've built something huge. You may be the one to take it over. You get one person to say that to you a year. I mean, you got another 50 years of your career. You get 50 empires.
Yeah, you're saying 50, you know, one person a week, about 50 people a year. And then if one of them every year or one of them every other year says yes, give it 10 years and you're going to get some property.
You're going to be
a significant amount.
Yeah, you're going to get 10 times the size of all the people who you originally went out and tried to emulate because you have time. And if you're older and you're hearing this and you're starting, it's like, okay, well, then maybe you get to acquire two empires. It's like you can build a massive portfolio. What I love about real estate, because real estate is super boring, by the way. Like, it's not that, it's fun, yeah. but it's not, it's repetitive. It's not that interesting. It's pretty cut and dry. It's what I love about it. It's so simple. It's been going on forever. There's no secrets in real estate. Like, yeah,
you're not inventing anything. You haven't invented anything.
Yeah. Creative finance is basically just saying not using a bank. It's not like it's even that creative. It's like, yeah. it's like, oh no, we can't write you a check for all of it right now. Well, let's pay you over time. Like, there's nothing in this that's like mind blowing.
Right. I've even thought about just tackling the phrase creative finance. Like, it's just financing.
That's all it is.
You're not a creative finance expert. You're just a finance expert.
Yeah. Like, creative finance just SEO as well on YouTube.
That's all. It does. Yeah. That's what people are looking for.
Yeah. Like, oh yeah. Creative finance. Like, create, it's not creative. Like, the whole bank process has not been around nearly as long as real estate. Like, you know how you bought real estate before the whole banking system?
You traded three goats and
you traded three goats, or you negotiated payments over time.
Yeah.
Like, that, this has been around forever. Seller financing is just another word of saying, way of saying negotiate something and then get everyone to sign off.
Yeah, that's man, I always once on every podcast just lose my train of thought because I get into the conversation and like I had something I was going to say next and then I lost it.
Oh, I know. And I know the feeling, because then the more you think about it, you're like, oh, my train got derailed. And then it's like, oh no, now it's going down a hill into a small village.
The more we're talking about it, the more it's gone. but yeah, real estate. Tell me about real estate.
So real estate's great. I like it. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
Since we talked last time, what is new in the universe of Tim? What are you guys buying now? Because you're doing a lot of creative deals too. Talking about creative financing, you're not using the banks as much as a lot of people.
Yeah, doing a lot of creative stuff with Shane. We got one of the coolest things is like we got four houses in December.
Yeah.
That were literally on Zillow in all caps, seller financing, low down payment available. Mm-hmm. And they sat on the market for like 7-8 months. And nobody else figured out the deal. So you know for a fact, people were calling, people were pitching it, people who watched a YouTube video last night were trying to get, you know, some sort of deal with this guy. We went, met him in person, saw all four of the houses, gave him an offer. He said no. And then Colin, who's doing the deal, sent him, I think, over the course, so to give you more context to it, it was December 20th, we called him.
Yeah.
He wanted to close before the end of the year.
Ooh. Tall order.
So we closed on the 29th of December. So over 9 days, Colin sent him 6 different offers. And it was just every day like, hey, will this work? Will this work? And he's like, yeah, it'll work. And then he's like, oh, I talked to my accountant. It won't work anymore. We got to do this. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, done deal. Went to the closing table, signed everything. Dude's our best friend now. But it was like brutal negotiation. And then I'm actually-
Which got it done.
Yeah. And I'm actually moving into one of the houses.
Oh, no way.
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So, going to have a backyard for the dog, all that stuff. We got countertops put in yesterday.
Dude, awesome. That's why I bought a house.
Exactly.
For the Frenchie.
Yeah. You got to have somewhere for the dogs.
Yeah. I had a condo and I was like, this is not working. We need to buy the dog a house.
Yeah. And so really just taking kind of because right now you have to a creative approach to the acquisition. So we were just working on a storage facility deal. We ended up canceling the contract because I went to see it in person and there was some stuff we found out we didn't know about before. Like at least 4 of the units had people living in them.
Mm.
The storage units.
Yeah.
That's
happening a lot lately. I've had a few storage friends who are like, dude, this keeps happening.
Apparently they've been there for about a decade. some of the units in the back had like, I don't know if it was a meth fire or what it was, but like the whole gate was just melted. Looked like 3 dumpsters had been turned over in the back of the place and all this stuff. And then it had drainage problems. It was going to cost a lot of money, but it was great terms. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. But man, what else are we working on? A bunch of multifamily stuff. We're going after bigger, like 50 to 150 unit multifamily right now.
Nice.
With kind of this approach, like, okay, you guys need to sell. You have a balloon coming up, like whatever situation it is. And I know things were better 2 years ago, but the reality is you have to sell now. And a traditional buyer is going to have to lowball you so much it hurts. They didn't have to do that in 2021. Yep. 2024, they'll have to do that. Or we can work this out. So I'm like sending offers on like 2 or 3 multifamily deals a day. And there's some stuff that some of every now and then, well, a lot of times with the commercial stuff, there's a broker involved. It's not all off market. Mm-hmm. So when there's a broker involved, it's like you're kind of explaining something that maybe the seller didn't understand through another person that maybe doesn't really understand it. Mm-hmm. So it's not always the best. Like, we really want to try to get the seller on the phone. But occasionally you run into a broker that does understand it, and it's amazing. Like, so we've got a property in just outside of South Carolina, and it is off market because I've built a relationship with the broker.
Yeah.
He had a relationship with the seller. They need to do something, but they bought it a year ago and they have no equity. So we're probably going to buy it on some sort of master lease or like land sale contract.
Yep.
Which would be cool.
Yep.
And we could now, I originally would have thought we buy this, keep it forever. But if we can get really, really good terms, we can get someone else to put money down and buy it from us. And now we have cash now, and they'll cash us out later with a profit baked into it.
There we go.
So that's a much different exit strategy than I would have ever thought of. My exit strategy would have been keep it forever.
Yep.
But now we can get some money up front and get cashed out later, and we don't have to do any of the work.
It's manage the resource pools, it, man.
It's kind only of
three
of them.
There's so only
we,
three.
Yeah. So we might be able to pull that up. I had a call just the other day with the broker and the sellers. Mm-hmm. The broker reiterated what I explained, and he did a perfect job. And they know him. They trust him more than they trust me, because that was the first time we met. So I think we're going to get it, which is really cool.
And yeah, then, that's really fun.
And then just kind of making sure like it does need work. We're probably going to try to buy it with very little money down or none. Mm-hmm. They seem kind of open to the idea of no money down, if as long as they're going to get it off their hands.
That's in budget.
Yeah, it is. I can afford no money down. So then someone who wants to get into real estate and has a lot of money, we can let them get into real estate and use their money.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we make some money for doing the deal.
Yep. It's just moving around the pieces and say like, hey, what's the best exit for where I'm at right now?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's taking the check. Sometimes that's the only time that's not allowed is when you're getting started. Buy the darn real estate, learn how to own real estate. You need to have the base. Once you've owned real estate, now you can look at, do we wholesale this? Do we package this and sell it to someone else on a wrap with the finance? You can do all these other plays. I think people focus on all the different strategies up front.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't own real estate today, your get only goal estate. Is buy real estate and hold real estate. Don't think past that. You're not an investor. Tell your investor. Once you are in the game and you have pieces on the table, all the options come up. And now you can do the hotel conversions. Now you can do the wholesales. Don't do these things out of order. I love everything that you're doing there. There's two questions that I always ask on my channel. So while I'm already interviewing you.
Yeah.
Highest stupid tax that you've ever paid. I mentioned this earlier, but the stupid tax is that when you come into anything new and you don't know what you don't know, there's always a fee that comes associated with it. Could, like for me, it cost like $300,000 on our first deal because I did a 2-to-1 for our investors on the buyout in 5 years, but we bought them out in 11 months. We didn't have like a tiered buyout. So I was like, oh shoot. So we borrowed at a little over 100% interest effectively when we, that sucks. Now we still made 7 figures. There's been multiple times in my business since then where I'm like, we're out of money. I need like $300,000 would be life-changing right now. And because I structured that deal incorrectly, while we still made a bunch of money, that $300,000 would have really come in handy. That was just a stupid tax of like, well, we won't make that mistake again. So for Tim, is there one that stands out in your career of like the highest stupid tax? What did you learn? What did that education buy you?
There's definitely been stuff with partners and current lawsuits that I can't really dive into too much.
You do have one. Yeah,
where, you know, certain things, expectations not being set up front and things happening that were not, I guess, held accountable and scrutinized in the way they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very big losses, like a lot of money. So that's a big thing, but I'm trying to think of something like on a specific deal.
Well, keeping it generic, I think there are some takeaways there. So just general, because I've had bad partnerships. I've in fact had a partner who's 50-50 who did zero work, even though he was 50%. He signed a management contract for my management company to manage the property. And then he is failing, but he is trying to sue me for every month of vacancy while he wasn't contributing to renovate. He wants my company to back pay him personally, not the LLC, but him personally, the rent for every month that wasn't leased, because it's my fault because I was paid. I gave 7 units. I managed it for $300 a month.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want all of that returned and I want you to pay me rent for our building because I didn't help you lease it. I'm like, there's like five logic errors in that statement by itself. I understand crappy partnerships and inadequate paperwork. If there was a takeaway from deal structure with partners that you've learned thus far in your career, what would you do differently in the way that you ink a deal with a new partner?
I think you need to know everything, like literally everything that's happening, and put it all in writing. So David Meltzer talks about this. Like, he puts everything in writing. If it's like a favor, like whatever it is, because honestly, do a lot of business. I don't know. I don't want to forget what we promised. Like, it's not that I don't trust you. It's not that you shouldn't trust me. It's like, there's a lot of stuff going on. We won't forget it if we put it in writing and sign it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a huge thing. And then just like, is anything you're involved in, you should know, like, there shouldn't be anybody that knows something better than you, like a business that you own or something that like you have money involved in. Another thing is, I've learned this lesson kind of through a fix and flip I partnered on, mm-hmm. is like being on top of contractors. And it's very similar things, setting expectations, knowing everything, verifying everything, scrutinizing everything. Because we got into a situation where a property we bought in July that should have been fixed up and sold by October is still not fixed up here at almost March.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Because the contractors were working on tons and tons of different flips and they were paid some money up front. And then they were doing so many projects with a little bit of money up front across a lot of projects was a lot of money, bought some new vehicles, you know, kind of couldn't pay their contractor or their subs anymore. It's like, oh, we gave you this money to do some work. You didn't pay your guys to do the work. And now you need more money to pay them, but we can't pay you that money. And now it's been, I'm not going to do the math on camera, but let's just say 8-9 months. And it's a sticky situation because they're out of money. They can't do the work, but we're out of money. We already paid them to do the work. And like, we were expecting to be in and out of this deal and like doing more. So it's like literally like one of the biggest lessons I learned in the last few months, honestly, is like you need to know everything and it should probably all be in writing as much as it can.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. And gosh, managing contractors, we won't go down that rabbit hole, but oh my gosh, that is such a huge part of this business. My wife, who's actually somewhere in the room on the other end of the cameras, Danny, she runs all of our maintenance for our portfolio, which is like, to be fair, like the main business is all her.
Mm-hmm.
I just get to talk about it and then
negotiate
the deals. And
I should be interviewing her.
Yeah, you really should. But when we put these together, it's like that is like her job is to ride every single contractor and not like ride them annoyingly, but like just consistently. She knows where every project is, every aspect of every unit that we own in the entire portfolio and our clients. She knows who's working on it, when they were last there, what the schedule is. And she does updates with all of the teams. You need to have one, get everything in writing, like you said, and then two, you need to have a way to hold everyone accountable. In my case, it's you just need to find yourself a Danny, but it needs to be like a person or a system where if you're someone who's really good with like CRMs, which I'm not, I put people, I'm good at hiring, I'm bad at tech, but if you're a CRM people, like a person, it'd be weird if you were a people. If you're a CRM person, organize it and keep a spreadsheet and check in on it and update it. If you have a really organized person in your org, you need one of them because things in writing are great, but I've had tons of stuff where like work just isn't being done because Cody and I are working on another project and no one's looking at the last project. And that's cost me a ton of money.
You get busy doing everything, not even just work stuff, life stuff. It's like there's too much opportunity for stuff you don't know about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it could be good. Sometimes it can be very bad. I was going to ask, and we probably need to wrap up here very soon, like the management stuff. Like, how did you learn to become a good operator of the multifamily?
We bought so much. And there's no other good managers in our county. Like, they're all quite bad. Either they rent way too low or they have terrible bookkeeping. We actually had a lot of deals that we wanted to buy bank financed but couldn't because the bookkeeping from their actual like property manager was too useless. The banks are like, this, we can't even use this. I'm like, okay, well, obviously they can't manage our portfolio. So we did it out of necessity. I think property management is not a business anyone should intentionally go into. It's low margin. It's high liability. It's a lot of work. And you have to be left and right brained, like 100%. Like, it's super high in service. And it's also super high in like accounting and financial responsibility. It's just not like a, it's just a hard business. No one wants to do that. Hmm. I did it because I had to. If I ever exited a company, that would be the one that I would sell. But you have to sell it to the right person because it manages my 200 units, then 100 units for other people. But I'm like, I can't tank my own personal business by giving their response. So you have to be very selective with it.
So my question is, why do the people that are bad at it get into the property management business, and how are they staying in business?
I think a lot of them want to be service providers. Like, I think people go like, I would love to own real estate one day, and people love to add steps. So they either become a real estate agent or they become a property manager. That's kind of the big two. Occasionally they'll go into like maintenance or construction, but they do something tangential to what they want to do. For me, it was going into CoStar. I spent 4 years selling to banks, property managers, owners before COVID hit. And I sat down for 2 seconds. I was like, I'm not doing what I want to do at all. I'm just qualifying myself. I think that's what a lot of people in property management do, is they're trying to be around real estate. And so they're taking the task that no one else wants to do. What they end up doing is they end up charging fees that often are crippling to the landlord, and they still have low margin. Like, especially on small properties, it's like 10% of the gross rents can kill your deal. For me, I just do fixed pricing. I'm like, cost X amount per unit to manage. And when I do a better job managing, you make more money, but you don't pay me more. And so I retain a ton of business, and I do it at a low enough margin where I'm like, I just need to get a bunch of units. And I have so many units now that I get a control market rent for my studios and my one beds, which conveniently I own a ton of. So when you can be the guy, this is where property management starts to make sense. When you can be the guy who a year, 2 years in goes, you know what? We've held rents at a certain place for one beds, and we control a majority of the one beds. We have 200 units, and all of them are going up $100 at the same time. For the you math people in a 6-cap market, take that new revenue, 200 times 100
times 12
times 12
divided by 0.06.
It equals a lot of money. That's math I'm comfortable with.
Yeah.
You make a lot of net worth, and you make a lot of additional cash flow. And that is something that you can do through property management. That's the only time I think it makes sense. One day, I don't know when, but at some point I'll probably exit that business, and I have to find someone who is another owner who can treat it like an owner. The only property managers that I've worked with that I've actually enjoyed are people who own significant real estate themselves. They manage their own stuff, and they've extended their business to clients because they have systems that work and they could expand a business out of that. Anyone else who is a service provider only is typically, in my experience, an inadequate service, just because property management is really hard.
Mm. That's a good point.
That's my 2 cents.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about starting it, don't.
Yeah, I'm not thinking about starting property. I've thought about it in the past, like early on. It was like, oh, let's just do this. It may potentially be a good lead source. Like, when your clients are ready to sell, you're like, oh, I'm ready to buy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that it's worth it.
Or just do one coffee meeting a week.
Right. It's good.
I like coffee better than managing a property.
This has been good. We got to get you ready to speak at the event here in a little bit.
That's right.
Bit.
We got to stop speaking and start speaking.
We do. So where can people find out more about you? Shout out anything you want to shout out.
Oh, there we go. You guys have questions? Christian Osgood on Instagram, just @ChristianOsgood. I'm most responsive there. And I do like 2 posts a day at least there. So, I mean, like, if you want to see like all the snippets, go there. YouTube channel, Multifamily Strategy. I share everything. I think we have well over 1,000 videos and endless shorts, but watch it there. I go live every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So another place to get questions answered. Lastly, multifamilystrategy.com. We have courses. I have a mentorship group that I actually teach all 3 weeks of. I don't outsource that. I am there every week. If you want to learn how to play the creative game, which is really just the buy things and don't lose them game, check me out there, multifamilystrategy.com.
All right. Thanks, Christian.